Okay, just a brief rundown of what this talk will be about today. First of all, a bit of background about what led me to pick this topic, and then a discussion about quite how bad the situation is. Do we really have a problem using XML? Some speculation about what some of the underlying causes might be, a proposal about maybe a new model that can overcome them, and then some implementation experiences, what actually happened when we tried to do that. I'll look at some features of the model that we tried to implement and then end up by thinking about some ways this could be taken forward if that's worthwhile. So just to give you a bit of background about where I'm coming from in relation to this topic. Feedback there. We are a very small company based in Cambridge in the UK, and we develop applications for processing XML, mainly doing Schematron-like validation of XML documents. We use Java because, well, we're used to it. Our clients like it. It runs reasonably well on various platforms and is well accepted. Most of the documents we deal with are for publishers. They're sort of narrative content. They're not data-like documents. And most of the models they use are schemas and DTDs that we didn't devise and we don't necessarily like very much. Truly, hell is other consultants. Also, we tend only to be interested in read-only XML. We're not changing the content. We're just looking at it. So that makes the problems I'm talking about here easy. Well, easier than if we were updating the content as well. So the problem, very crudely stated, is that processing big XML documents is too slow. And or it takes up too much memory in circumstances where we don't really have an option but to build an in-memory representation of the entire XML document. I put a little asterisk there saying probably, because there is a school of thought that it might be possible to process XML entirely using streaming methodologies, but there's also a school of thought that it's not possible to do that. So I'm keeping my asterisk there as a proviso. I think tree representations of XML are increasingly important because people are doing more validation, they're using XML for transactions, XML is being pumped from machine to machine, and people are expecting to do operations on that XML as it comes in. They want to route it to a location, or they want to validate it, and these type of operations typically require building in-memory representations of that XML. What does big mean? I suppose big means it gives you a problem. Either something is too slow or takes too much memory. There's no absolute size we can say here. We used to use a test document from a customer, but recently the standardization of OXML, DIS 29500, has given us a useful public test document we can use for benchmarking. It's a 60 megabyte document. It's available on the open web, and it's fairly meaty. So if we take that 60 megabyte document and do some common operations on it, these are the sort of figures we get. If we want to build a DOM on top of that document, takes 14 seconds, uses 231 megabytes of memory, as you can see. Doing an XSLT identity transform using Saxon, it's 40 seconds, and remarkably, only a bit more memory. And passing it, streaming pars, of course, hardly takes any memory at all and is fairly quick. And some of that will be Java startup overhead. The details for these tests are in the printed version of this paper. By the way, it struck me after I've done this and was looking at this slide this morning that the reason why this might be quite good for DOM, much better than when I last did the test in 2006, was that it switched to a lazy implementation for default when you build a DOM in Java. Is that the case? Does anybody know? Semi-lazy, right? So the challenge is, can we improve on these figures? Is there a particular cause of the problem here? In fact, is there only one single cause, or is there a variety of causes? And are we faced with a classic situation in which there's a speed-memory trade-off, i.e. if we make it much faster, will we be having to use much more memory? And if we save lots of memory, will we perforce make it much slower? And of course, even if we can solve the problem in theory, can we still use a familiar API? It's all very well solving the problem from an academic point of view and having something that sits there using not very much memory, but it's not very much use if we can't use the libraries we're familiar with to do real-world operations on that content. I think taking a slightly contrary view about trade-offs, I like this quote from John Bentley. In his book Programming Pearls, he says it's been his experience that reducing a program's space requirements also reduces its runtime. So it's often the case, I think, we find that if we do take care to use memory resources sensibly, we can sometimes reduce the execution time, and traditional trade-off laws do not apply. Some observations. This very simple Java program creates a million strings, very small strings. Each of the string is the text representation of that number. Now, the amount of the number of digits stored is 5.89 million. So if we take a byte for each, we can assume about 6 megabytes. More realistically, if we take 2 bytes for each, we can say about 12 megabytes would be the native space required for this operation. But in fact, if we run that, we find it takes 50 megabytes to store that content, to create that content. So I think we can reckon generally, as a very rough rule of thumb, that every Java string we create is going to cost us about 40 bytes of data. And of course, we have some overhead for creation and destruction of Java objects. So any typical naive implementation of a Java in-memory model is going to be costly right away if we're using objects all the time. However, I observe if we use bytes, a million bytes costs exactly 1 million bytes. If we want to implement DOM, we have a slight problem in that DOM, by its very nature, commits us to an object-heavy implementation. If you look at the node class itself, it declares 17 methods that return objects. So as soon as we're using DOM, we're buying into a whole object way of thinking. Generally, of course, any tree-based implementation that uses objects is going to commit us to an object-heavy way of thinking. So it's very difficult to use standard APIs, which expect objects all over the place, if we want to move away from using objects. The premise, I think, is that we should beware objects and befriend bytes, which might seem a retrograde step, but falling back on an earlier, more primitive way of using Java, where we're manipulating bytes rather than using high-level objects all the time. Java, perhaps, not as we generally know it. How's this work in practice? If you consider this very simple XML document, one way of thinking of it is as a stream of events. Those of you who use SACS, of course, will be familiar with that kind of concept. But stepping away from SACS a little bit, let's just think what this document's stream of events might look like. First of all, obviously, we have the start of the document. Then we have the start of an element, in this case. And associated with that element that started there is a string, which, in this case, the name of the element. Attribute, which also has an associated string, which is the name of the attribute. Then an attribute value, which too has an associated string, and so on. So we're building up an event list of events, if you like, that represent how that document is, or how it's constructed, or how it's parsed. Interspersed with the various events to do with XML structures, we have the strings which represent the content. I said we're stepping away from SACS a little bit, and you'll notice this is not a SACS stream, and it's not a SACS stream for two reasons. First of all, I'm suggesting it's something that we're going to persist. We're actually going to store this in memory or on disk, whereas a SACS stream is some events that fire, and then we're free to do what we want with them. It's just a series of transient events. It's also more finely grained than SACS. SACS gives us attribute sets as, well, the attributes on an element as a single collection of things, whereas in this model here, each of the attributes is a separate event. It is, if you like, a piano roll. By replaying the events here, we can rebuild the XML tree, or the XML document, exactly as we first received it. Another feature of this concept is that we have two kinds of events. The orange ones are structural phenomena, if you like. They're the XML structure of the document that are fired, the events that are fired, whereas the blue things are the content, the strings, the attribute values, and the element content, and so on. Text content. We can think about representing the structural phenomena in the XML document using values, each of which takes a single byte. Now, the actual numbers here aren't important, but what you might notice is that the high bit is set for all of the values used for these events. You'll also notice that we can represent all the standard XML infoset items and still have plenty of space left in our value space for other events we might want to record later on. I'll come back to that. As well as the structural phenomena, of course, we have to store the string content, the attribute values, and the text content. They're, after all, perhaps the most important thing in your document. We're marking up that content. A sensible approach here would seem to be to use a dictionary and then to refer to the strings in the dictionary by index. XML documents always have, well, in this model anyway, at least one duplicate string, which is the, you'll see the start and end of the same element. And often XML documents have lots and lots of duplicated strings. So it would seem that normalizing that would be a very sensible way of reducing memory use, assuming we weren't doing it already. So that's the model. We have the structural phenomena in orange and the content phenomena in blue, and we use indexes to refer into a dictionary or a list of strings which we're storing elsewhere. We can see that string events are always delimited by structural events. They're always interspersed with each other. And as we'll see in a bit, we never set the high bit, the string lookup values. We're going to use instead 7-bit numbers to represent lookup values so we can distinguish between the structural events and the string events in the content. So this is what the stream, the beginning of that document that we've been looking at would look like if it was held in memory. We have on the right the sort of human readable form of the events, a start document, start element, and a reference to a string, and so on. And on the left, we have the byte values we're using to represent those things. In the middle is the bitwise representation of those events, those things. And you notice that the high bit is set for the structural phenomena, so we can clearly distinguish between what is structure and what is string content. Of course, there's going to be many situations when we want to refer to indexes of string content which are higher than what we can hold in 7 bits, so we have to have an encoding mechanism for referring to numbers higher than 127 decimal. So if you want to represent the number 200, we could do it like this. You'll see that the two numbers there are using a 7-bit coding sequence to represent higher numbers than 127. But again, the principle is we can always see that there's interspersal between structural phenomena and textual phenomena in the document. Just as a thought, I mean, another way of thinking of this is it's like we have instructions for representing things that we want to create or represent in XML documents, and then operators, if you like, for saying how that instruction should be interpreted. So a start document is just an instruction that has no numbers associated with it, whereas a start element has a single string, which is that element's name. An attribute has two strings associated with it, which is the attribute name and the attribute value. I don't know, but that's interesting. So what happened when we tried to implement this? Early implementation used a SAX reader to create the stream. So you can take the SAX events and then carve them up a little more finely to create the stream I was talking about. We used a simple hash map of strings for the string table, so that's not optimal for all the reasons I was talking about earlier. We've got the object overhead and so on, but hey, we're getting the normalization. And the early implementations also did not handle all of the infoset. Looked promising, so he went ahead and implemented the whole thing. Issues. Now, the biggest issue was that the thing ran like a pig in treacle. It was very, very slow to query the stream. And that's because, largely we found, because all the scanning that was taking place. The stream was very efficient, but it was very slow to access any part of it because you had to iterate over the stream values in order to find anything that you wanted. Especially if you think about it, it was very slow to iterate over the stream looking for things like following siblings because you'd have to iterate over all the descendant content before you eventually got to the following sibling you were looking for. So to try and speed things up, we introduced three strategies which pay dividends. Now the first of these is something I've called pseudo-events, which are things we introduce into the stream to try and make things more efficient. Now you remember earlier on I was talking about how we had plenty of space left to represent things other than traditional infoset items, and this is where that extra space comes in useful, because we can introduce events into the stream which represent signposts, if you like, for iterators, so that they can move much more efficiently around. If you look at the sort of blobs on that diagram, you see that there's the blue and orange ones representing the structural phenomena and the text phenomena we were talking about earlier, but also this new green one, which is, if you like, a signpost for an iterator to say, if you're looking for the following sibling, you just need to skip 5,000 bytes forward in this case. So it would remove all that unnecessary scanning that we were suffering from before. I think I should note here that this is a classic memory speed trade-off, that each of these pseudo-events is, of course, increasing the amount of memory we're using, but it is giving us a speed increase. They can, of course, be placed anywhere in the content, and we can make them up as we want. In the end, we ended up settling on, at the moment, these signpost events for speeding up the iterators for the stream, one for following sibling information, one for preceding sibling information, and one for information about the parent of that particular element, so an iterator can find those things quickly if it's moving through the stream. All of these signposts specify new stream positions where you need to go to find the phenomena it describes. Other events I just mentioned that we record C-data sections because we have strange clients that want to validate whether things are in C-data mark sections for some reason. And we also record line and column numbers because our users insist on seeing line and column information for everything that's returned. And that is actually quite a big overhead. That takes a lot of memory to do that, as you'll see later on. Strategy number two was better string representation. You remember I talked earlier about how we used a simple hash map in the proof of concept. It's much more efficient to represent all of the text content as a single stream of characters, and then have offsets into that, rather than have a hash map or other structure. And of course, Java being Unicode, most of the Unicode characters fit into 2 bytes, so that is how we've represented it here. No sort of cheating for English content or so on. Interesting problem we had was also dynamic container expansion, that most Java containers, and so the ones we designed as well, obviously they need to resize when you try to put something into them and they're not big enough. And generally their behavior is to double in size when you hit this barrier, which is generally a sensible thing to do, but it's not a very sensible thing to do in many situations when you're passing XML, because you're hitting threshold values all the time and you end up with dynamic containers which are resized and they're much too big for your actual purpose. So in order to overcome this, the strategy number three we introduced was something called document sniffing. So you pass the document once before you actually build the tree, and you collect statistics about the document so you know exactly how much space you're going to need in order to store all the information you want to. Then you allocate that memory and store your stuff in the memory that you have allocated. You remember earlier I had a table showing how much memory was used for particular operations. I think that transient, that and that was measured by actually running the thing on the command line and then seeing, does it work or does it fail? I think that transient memory usage is very important. That, I mean, one could argue here that we could just trim back these dynamic containers after the pass and reclaim the memory that's been wasted, but I think the key question is, do you have enough memory to run the operation in the first place? So I want never to have to trim back excess memory that's been unnecessarily allocated. So where we currently are, we've got some benchmarks for the implementation. Remember, building a DOM document took 14 seconds. The frozen stream takes 11 seconds. The DOM, the lazy DOM. If it's a partially lazy DOM, it would, of course, take much more memory if I did anything useful with it. The lazy DOM took 331 megabytes, and we've done quite a bit better with 117 megabytes. If we store the line and column information, which we need to, you'll see that spoils things slightly, that we've got 217 megabytes, which is comparable with the DOM implementation, and it takes longer as well. I said earlier we wanted something that was useful rather than just of academic value, so the next challenge is how do you do that? I suppose one thought is that you might want to put an API on top of the structure that you've built. But do we really want another API for XML? And if we did, I think what this model suggests is an iterator-based API, because that's the underlying model of how we access the data. And perhaps one that used XPath axes, so we could set an axis and a direction and then let the iterator iterate. However, that would not be very useful because there are no libraries out there that recognize such an API. So our approach was instead to try and implement XPath, so you could actually carry out XPath queries on the document. The reason we did that is I think XPath is a fairly sane way to interact with XML in code. You build the tree, you write your XPath queries to get at the information that you want rather than manually walking the tree. And also because we're interested in Schematron, having something that supported XPath would of course be very interesting for us. The library we chose was Jackson, which we've got some familiarity with, and it's a stable library. It's especially since Elliot Rusty Harold got involved, it's been very well tended to. High performance and conformant XPath 1 library, I should say here. It's at that URL. Integration with libraries in general is difficult because we have a representation that is based on bytes, whereas most libraries out there expect a tree of nodes type model or a standard DOM or something. However, Jackson is attractive because it works with any model which can provide axis iterators for iterating XPath axes. In theory, all we needed to do was to provide XPath axis iterators on top of our frozen stream, and we could integrate the Jackson library with it. However, digging a bit deeper, we found that Jackson 2 is predicated on the representation of nodes as objects. So that led to us needing to rewrite Jackson entirely so that it itself was also built around integers representing positions in byte streams rather than using objects. And that took a while. Now, this is the point in the presentation where things went a little awry. You'll see two things up there. On the left is norovirus, and this knocked me out for a couple of days last week. And on the right is a chickenpox virus, which knocked out my colleague Andrew Sales for a whole week, and he's done most of the heavy lifting on this project. However, I can say informally that the results of implementing this and implementing Schematron on top of it are promising so far, that running the standard Schematron ISO templates with Saxon gives a speed, but running our implementation seems to be twice as fast, but using 30% more memory. Our implementation can, of course, be tuned to be leaner and slow. If we get rid of some of the features I mentioned earlier, we can be much more compact, but performance will suffer, speed will suffer. The code will be released under GPL license as something called Probotron, which will be a Java implementation of Schematron. So what other optimizations could be carried out on this frozen stream? One thought I had was, is it amenable to assembly language programming to try and make things even faster? Since the basic operation is just iterating over bytes, it would seem that that might be an approach that would pay dividends, especially if it leveraged some of the clever tricks you can do with modern chips. I noticed Intel's done some interesting work in this area with its toolkit, but on going to their site, I see the products being withdrawn and rolled into something called an SOA Express Bus or something. So that seems to have gone away. But it looked very interesting when it lasted. There's other interesting features of the frozen stream. They're highly amenable to being paged to disk, of course, because they have no dependencies on other parts of themselves, or split across machines. So there's some interesting possibilities there for minimizing memory usage or having some kind of multi-process, multi-machine approach to treating them. Also noticed recently there's a trend using multimedia hardware to do operations on things which are amenable to blitting and so on. Again, because we're dealing with basic bytes, operations on them might well be moved into the high-performance RAM on our multimedia and our graphics cards and then dealt with that way. Another option, of course, maybe to design custom hardware to deal with these kind of memory structures efficiently if we can optimize the hardware itself to deal with these structures well. So conclusions, and I should say this talk is based on something, a talk I first gave in Montreal when it was still theory back in 2006, and the situation has improved a lot since then. Java itself has got a lot better, and Saxon has got a lot better. But in-memory trees are still expensive. I said Saxon's got better. It's very, very hard to beat it. Truly deserves the label as the Rolls-Royce of XML libraries. I don't think we've necessarily done any better than it has achieved. And 100% streaming still remains the holy grail. That's another topic for another talk, perhaps. But if we could really move away from building these in-memory trees, that would be ideal. I think users might value the ability to choose whether they want to have high speed or good memory use, especially if they're having to validate large amounts of XML and they don't care how fast it happens. As I said, maybe there is some scope for extreme optimizations using some of those slightly more blue sky techniques I spoke about towards the end of the presentation. Thank you very much.
Please repeat the question so it can be recorded.
So we have plenty of time for questions. Maybe Mike.
Yes, if you go back to the Montreal version of my talk, you'll see there's a section on flyweight objects, and we did think about that. But it seems Jackson needs to have a lot of these objects in memory at once in order to do operations. So we bit the bullet and went the whole hog doing the integer-based lists instead. I mean, for the sort of validations we do, we often seem to get in a situation where we need to have huge node sets in memory at the same time in order to compare them. So we were moving back towards the object problem if we were going to do that, I think, and that's why we rejected that approach and went for the rewrite instead.
Other questions?
So the question is, does using 7-bit representation for strings have a cost implication? Not that we've measured. I don't think, compared to the other things that are going on, the cost of manipulating things at that level would be expensive. But that's just a hunch. I haven't measured it. Inigo. Okay, so the question is, did we think about adjusting the behavior of the dynamic containers so they didn't double in size but grew at a more sensible rate? And the answer is, in the end, the dynamic container that was the biggest problem was our own dynamic container for the byte array itself, that we'd eliminated most of the other native Java ones. I suppose we didn't think about that because perhaps we took a too purist approach and said, well, we either want a complete solution, we can't bother with this faffing around with 10% growth and so on. So the pre-sniffing approach was intellectually appealing because it gave you an absolutely correct answer about how much memory you needed. And also, for the sort of documents we're generally dealing with, it's very inexpensive to have a pre-parse to get that information. So we bypassed that, I think, on our way to the final solution. Well, it should have been announced here, but as I say, the virus has laid us low. We'll make it available soon, very soon.
Very soon.
Very soon.
Hope it will be different soon than for expert.
Any other questions? So thank you again, Alex.
Thank you.